Antitrust and big tech, and when a disaster is not a disaster.
Criminal justice and the immigration system, and the Alien Enemies Act. Welcome to Downsampled News. Hello and welcome to Downsampled News. My name is B-Lock and I'm here with my father,
Richie B.
Oh, I wonder where you got that from. And we are here, today is May 9th of 2025, but we're talking about news stories from April of 2025. We're filming it on May 9th because I had finals and I'm still doing them. So if I look just like totally shot, that's why. But we are going to talk about stories today mostly from April 2025. One of mine's maybe from May 1st-ish, but it's around the same time. I did want to highlight, yes. I was right.
Okay, tell me about it.
I know this is a rare occurrence for me to be right. Actually, it's a very common occurrence. I'm right very frequently. if you recall on our last episode, on our inaugural episode, I complained about the way that more liberal speakers on the internet were talking about the immigration situation and how people weren't focusing on the fact that it's due process regardless of who's involved. That the person doesn't need to be a good person to get due process. That's a red herring. You noticed it too, that on the various podcasts and YouTubes and stuff, they finally started saying that.
Yes.
Yeah. So I was right. I was ahead of everyone else. And that's why you should listen to us and follow us. any other updates from last month that you want to talk about?
Well, I want to talk. At the end, I would like to get back to AI and copyright. Mm-hmm. I have some interesting thoughts.
Oh, okay. Perfect. All right. So then let's get started with our stories. You ready?
Okay. Okay. So I would like to talk about antitrust and big tech. So as always...
Just a small topic, bite size.
So I would like to talk a little bit about history of antitrust. Mm-hmm. And I read the Wikipedia, so I'm an expert.
That's what I do for work. What is robbery? I don't know. Let me Google that.
So the interesting reason why this thing is called antitrust, because back in the 19th century, late 1800s, there were companies that were formed kind of groups, which were called trusts. Mm-hmm. So where they basically kind of trusted each other, so to speak. Mm-hmm.
Clever.
So if one company owned the railroad and another company owned the mills where they collected the wheat, they would agree that if you use my railroad, then we would charge you lower prices of somebody and charge high prices of somebody else. Mm-hmm. Essentially, monopolies. So in 1890, there was an act passed named after Sherman, who was the congressman, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It was Antitrust Act, who said basically trusts are not legal. That's bad because people get ripped off with mm-hmm. High prices. And initially, there wasn't much done. I think it's only when Teddy Roosevelt became president, he became the big trust buster. There was a company called Standard Oil, which was owned by the Rockefellers, which you may have heard of.
The name rings a bell.
And they kind of monopolized the production and delivery and stuff of oil, and they made lots of money, and they were broken up. That's why we have several different oil companies these days. Mm. And there were some corrections to this act early in the 20th century, and I forgot the actual date, but it was like in the 20s maybe, where they basically said monopolies are not legal.
Mm.
Right? Fair because enough. A monopoly controlling a monopoly meaning there's only one company that provides a particular service or a good, and then they can charge whatever prices they want. Right, because there's no competition.
Monopolies are my limited understanding of economics.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine the monopolies are kind of counter to the entire like theory behind capitalism, right? Because like the idea of capitalism is everybody's trying to make the best product for you, but if only one person's making the product, then it can be terrible, and they can charge you whatever they want for it.
Right. Yeah. And somebody said recently, I think maybe Cory Doctorow, that capitalists actually hate capitalism. Because they want to have monopoly so they can control everything.
Fair enough.
Anyway, so the law is pretty strong that regardless what the effects of the thing were, monopoly was not legal.
Mm-hmm.
Then along comes Robert Bork.
Okay.
Have you heard of him?
I have not heard of Robert Bork.
Robert Bork was a judge, a lawyer. He...
Of course, he ruined everything. That's what lawyers do.
Yes, he did. Although he was... I forget which president was it, Reagan, I think, proposed him to be on Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And he went down, and he was not confirmed. The confirmation hearings were very ugly.
Hmm.
And so that's why when people lose in confirmation hearings these days, it's called being borked.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know that.
But anyway, he provided some case law and opinions about monopolies and antitrust. And basically he said, what really matters, it's not whether companies are monopolies, it's whether consumers are hurt. So if there's a monopoly that charges lower prices, that's just fine. It's sometimes more efficient to just have one company than a dozen.
Hmm.
And that was the kind of point of view that was taken by FTC, which is the Federal Trade Commission, which is the agency that is entrusted with enforcing antitrust laws.
Mm-hmm.
And basically through this was, I guess, early 80s, up until fairly recently, basically what FTC took the hands off, basically, and mm-hmm. allowed kind of corporations to merge and become larger and larger. And until we arrive at today, where we have a lot of companies that, a lot of markets that are controlled by one or two companies, even like look at airlines, right?
For example. I was just thinking actually, EasyPass, Judge Bork said, sometimes it's easier just have one company control everything. Mm-hmm. I don't know how EasyPass isn't considered a monopoly or if it is.
Well, it's government, so it's different. So.
Oh, that's the government? I thought it was a private. I thought EasyPass was a private company.
No, that's probably EasyPass money goes to the government, but it's probably contracted out to implement.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, government is allowed to have monopolies.
Yeah.
So what happened was that companies were allowed to become very large and very controlling, and in tech, that became, the Bork doctrine became kind of important because they were not charging anything for the products to the consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's two types of monopoly. There's something called monopoly, which is when there's only one seller.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something called monopsopy, which is when there's only one buyer.
Monopsopy.
Right. So Amazon is a kind of both, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because if you want to sell something online, essentially you have to go to Amazon and sell through Amazon, and that's the only choice that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What happened was the three tech companies, Meta, which is Facebook, Google, and Apple, kind of grew to become monopolies in certain areas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So Apple is a monopoly with the App Store, right? So anything you get, any application you put in the iPhone has to come from the App Store. And there are some actually copyright related laws that protect them. So it's illegal to jailbreak phones, right?
Mm.
So
this was one of the issues with the TikTok ban, which is
still
floating in the ether, that the way it was going to be implemented was that there was going to, if the law was in fact implemented, the way it worked is that it punished the company who allowed the app to be sold.
Right.
So if Apple was not allowing it to be sold, then nobody had, right, that's how they were going to shut it down. Yeah.
And Google has something similar to a lesser extent with its App Store. The thing about Apple App Store is they charge 30% tax, basically.
Mm-hmm.
If you sell anything to the App Store, Apple gets 30% tax cut, and that's the only option. And so that's kind of monopoly and the kind of exploiting the people who try to sell sell apps, right? And Google's monopoly is there are a couple of them because they're such big people in search.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. So to us, search is free. And one of the arguments that said, our customers can go to any other search engine they want.
Mm.
However, Google has been paid a lot of money to Apple, Samsung, and other phone makers to put Google search as the default search on the phone.
Oh, interesting.
So Apple is getting like $20 billion a year from Google, right? And they paid so that's one part. That's kind of like the trust, you know?
Yeah.
And the other one was Google sells ads, and they essentially the only game in town. If you want to publish ads on the web, Google is the biggest, and they basically you have to go to Google, so they can charge whatever they want. They're the only,
I mean, that's
the only buyer.
That's a good question in terms of like, what is a monopoly? Like, is it their fault that like they're just really good, you know, like they're quite good in like a
right. So that was the argument by Robert Bork, is that, you know, the product turns out to be good, and then something's kind of natural monopolies in a sense. If there's only one, things can be more efficient. But sometimes being efficiency is not necessarily the goal or the best thing to do. There's a book coming out by Kara Doctorow about enchantification.
Called what?
Enchantification.
Enchantification. Oh, okay.
That was the word for last year. And basically what happens is that if you have a company that controls everything, then they can start adding features to the products that are good for them, not for the customers.
Well, so that's been a theory. I don't know if this is true, and now my FBI agent's going to know I'm talking about it. And so is Apple, because we're using my phone to film it. the theory on the internet is that every time the iPhone updates, it slows it down to get you to buy the next phone. And I don't know if that's true or not.
No.
But I don't know. I don't know. Yeah, tinfoil hats. But that's, I mean, they could.
But I mean, that's that. Right. That's an example of a certification, because they have total control.
Right.
So anyway, and with Facebook purchased WhatsApp and Instagram when Instagram was very small, but was growing much faster than Facebook and was a competition to Facebook. So they kind of bought it and kind of sort of suppressed it a bit.
That's, again, not to bring everything back to TikTok, but that's one of our concerns, TikTok users, is that if any kind of sale goes through for the TikTok app, that it will become like shitty and unusable.
Yes.
Yeah.
So anyway, so the enforcement was kind of laid back and by FTC until Joe Biden came to the office and he appointed Lina Khan. Have you heard of her?
I have heard of Lina Khan, yes.
Yeah, she's kind of a brilliant lawyer, the same age as you, or maybe a year or two older, so I'm still waiting.
Oh, God.
And she started getting serious about enforcement of some of the stuff. So Meta, Google, and Apple were taken to court, and they lost in various places, right? Mm-hmm. So, and in fact, currently there are hearings going on the Google case about the remedy. In fact, there's a hearing today.
Oh.
There was an article in the New York Times this morning about these hearings. So the rough cases are with Meta and Facebook is about purchase of Instagram. Now, one of the things that Mark Zuckerberg did, he's not very smart in some ways. And
shocker.
Although I don't know if you heard it, he drinks coffee recreationally.
What?
Yes. Never mind. So
what happened? Someone's gonna take that chain away from him. He thinks he's much cooler than he is.
When they were considering purchase of Instagram, he wrote an email saying we have to buy them and kill them because they're competition. Which is like really the worst thing you could say.
Probably a bad thing to put in writing.
So all that stuff was in writing, and that kind of came out in the cases. I think that case is still going. Google kind of lost. They said they have a monopoly in search, and especially the fact that they're paying people off to put the search as the default search on various devices and browsers is one thing, and the other one is the ad business, which is the really how Google makes money. Google is really just an ad company with some side hustles.
Yeah. What a great way to describe them.
So they're discussing the remedy for Google, and there's arguments back and forth. So I'm sure this is going to continue. And for Apple, the biggest thing is the Apple Store thing. But apparently, and I haven't read the article details, but it just came out that Apple actually lied in some depositions.
Shocked.
So, no, I mean,
people lie in those things all the time.
Well,
you shouldn't. Don't do that. But like, they do.
And they're trying to play games with the orders that they were given to them, so they might get into more trouble.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the state of play. Well, so the one interesting thing that I was going to say is that everybody expected when the current administration came in
mm-hmm.
that they would, I mean, Lina Khan left FTC, mm-hmm. and they expected that all these cases would just
peter out, disappear. Yeah.
Right. And which you may have noticed at who was present at inauguration and who contributed to inauguration fund.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's right. The tech bro, for those who don't recall, that's all the tech bros
right.
went to the inauguration.
But apparently the dislike of tech monopolies is equal on both the left and right. So the cases are continuing.
Mm.
So the person who replaced Lina Khan at FTC still wants to proceed with the enforcement. So that's kind of an interesting thing. It's, I don't want to say it. So historically, in the past, there were like two big cases in antitrust. One was IBM,
mm-hmm.
which was at one time the company for computers.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one was Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
Microsoft, but also AT&T, which is a telephone company.
Mm-hmm.
So at one time there was IBM and they were sued for, to be broken up, and they fought it and they lost. They won. They weren't breaking up. So, AT&T, which was phone company, there was only one phone company. If you imagine that, there was just, you could get only one kind of phone, one kind of phone company. There were no cell phones. There were no smartphones.
We're truly living in the future right now.
Look at
all the tech we have now.
So the breakup happened in the late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Which is relatively recent, and that led to an explosion of technologies, right? So you could have argued that service was better with AT&T because it was just one company and very efficient. However, it was just preventing innovation.
Yeah, it was stagnant.
And the innovation just with the phones, you can see what happened. The effect on IBM was interesting, though. So even though they were not punished, when they went to develop the personal computer, the PC, they did not want to kind of fall under the area of FTC, so they developed it as a kind of separate division, and they kept the hardware very open so that anybody could duplicate it. That's why we had PC clones. They asked Microsoft to write the operating system so that it wasn't all IBM, so they could see we're not monopolistic.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there was another explosion of innovations because everybody was building PC clones. PCs came everywhere, and so forth. So those were kind of interesting effects of enforcement of these laws. So it's kind of interesting to see what will happen.
Well, how do you even make something like Google?
So Google has a bunch of different... Google is part of this larger conglomerate called Alphabet, right? But like, for example, the Chrome browser, we could spin that off into its own company. You can spin YouTube into its own company.
Does Google own YouTube?
Yes.
Oh. Well, we love Google, and we love it. It's great.
So from the point...
Love us, YouTube.
The interesting thing about that is that people who follow like stock market and investments, if they predict that if you split Google from YouTube, the two companies separately would be worth more than together in terms of just
interesting. Yeah, that makes sense.
Right. So we'll see what happens. It's possible that nothing will happen, and there'll, of course, be appeals, and et cetera, et cetera. So that's going to drag on for years, just like with IBM.
Mm-hmm.
But it may prevent some of the very anti-competitive behavior of some of these companies.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my story. This is something that's going to be continuing. The interesting part this month was that there were some hearings and Mark had to testify, and Sundar was testifying, and all those guys.
Zuckerberg is terrible at testifying. He's seen him testify before.
He's not a real boy.
He's not a real boy.
Okay.
That's interesting, though. So, yeah, we have to keep tabs on that,
mm-hmm.
and we will cover it in the future as things develop. So, your topic was, that was pretty small, pretty bite-sized. My topic is similarly bite-sized. It's about the criminal justice system in general.
Oh. Big bite.
So it's fine. So this past month, on several occasions, Orange Cheeto Dictator made some kind of comment about wanting to send homegrown, that was his phrase, homegrown criminals to foreign prisons. And he's said this multiple times. So I don't know, he like got the, he does this where he like gets an idea and like says it out loud and then like kind of like starts to say it out loud more. And people have obviously said like, this is crazy, you can't deport American citizens. But I wanted to look at it from a criminal justice perspective of how that idea would absolutely decimate the entire criminal justice process in the United States. Just completely.
Huh?
Okay. So I'm a criminal defense attorney. I actually work with immigration attorneys a lot because when we have clients who are not citizens, whether they're here without papers or whether they have a green card, permanent residence, whatever it is, different crimes can already get you deported. Serious crimes already get you deported if you're not a citizen. Even if you're like lawful, whatever, and you commit like a murder or something like that, you already get deported for that. So why there's suddenly the push to deport the violent criminals confused me always, because we already do that. So, but if you, what happens then when I have a client who, like, let's say I have a client who commits your regular run of the mill, like, I don't know, burglary or something.
Shoplifting
sometimes can lead to deportation, but usually it's more things that are more violent. So like an assault, for example, like they attack somebody, they punch somebody, something like that. You know, those aren't good crimes. We don't want people to do crimes at all. Take that strong stance here at Downsampled News. Don't do crimes. But if I have an American citizen who does that, they usually, we work out a deal. They do like some probation. Maybe they do some jail time and then they go live their lives. If I have a non-citizen, this is a whole extra layer of having to figure out what's going to happen to their status and if they're going to get deported. And I personally have had cases that have gone to trial because there was no way for the person to safely plead guilty because they would get deported. So what does that mean, ultimately? The vast majority of cases in the United States resolve by way of what we call plea bargain. For those who don't know, a plea bargain or a plea deal is when the criminal defendant says, like, all right, like, I did it, like, I did this thing, I'm willing to admit I did this, I'm willing to admit guilt, in exchange for promise of a certain kind of sentence. So, like, instead of going to trial and doing the whole thing, the whole get a jury, get a judge, get witnesses, get evidence, make the victim relive it again, like the whole thing. Instead of doing all that, I'm willing to just admit guilt in exchange for, you know, a sentence that's acceptable to me, whatever that looks like, and given the circumstances. You can't do that if that plea of guilt is going to lead to the person getting deported. That means you have to go to trial because you have to try to just get the acquittal instead. That causes a lot of harm, because when otherwise all the parties would agree to a conclusion, when the judge and the prosecutor, defense attorney, defendant, and victim are all on board for a resolution, the system should allow that to happen. It shouldn't be like we have to go to trial, because that's bad for everybody. That happens in a small sliver of cases right now, because there are a small number of people that are involved in the criminal justice system and are non-citizens. By the way, the vast majority of people in the criminal justice system, citizens. Well, most people who commit crimes in this country, Americans. So, like, the non-citizens don't commit, like, lots of crime. They really don't. So what happens, though, if you broaden that threat and you take the threat of deportation and apply it to all people?
To homegrown criminals.
And therefore apply it to everyone in the system. I'll tell you exactly what happens. As a defense attorney, I take every case to trial, which shuts down the criminal justice process, because you can't. There are too many cases. There are far too many cases to take every single case to trial. And you would get, basically, your justice system would grind to a halt, because I would never be able to advise a client that they would be safe taking a plea. It could be their first offense, it could be their first shoplifting, but if it's possible, because the government's deporting other people right now, and maybe initially it's the government, oh, we're only deporting homegrown gang members or something. What if they change their mind? and my client has now a shoplifting on their record, and 2 years from now, somebody comes knocking at their door and snatches them up and sends them to El Salvador, you know? So opening that floodgate would cripple the criminal justice system. And I'll tell you exactly what would happen. If we had to try every single case, prosecutors would have to dismiss a lot. They'd have to dismiss a lot of cases because the not serious ones would never get to trial. And I'm not saying not serious in the sense of like, think like this. As an example, mm-hmm. Your car is parked outside your house. You left your wallet in your car. I do that sometimes. Someone in the middle of the night smashes your window, takes your wallet. A day or two later, you report to the police. A day or two later, your credit card is used the next state over. They go pick the guy up. He's got your wallet on him. He admits to it. He took your wallet. That's pretty straightforward. That would resolve in a court in like one or two court dates, right? That person would probably get probation. He'd have to pay you back for your broken window. You'd get your wallet back, you know, that kind of thing. If there was a threat of deportation for doing that, you're not getting your window paid for. You're not getting your wallet back. And that man's never going to trial because that's just not that serious of a case. It would end up getting dismissed and nothing would happen. So it really is like I was thinking about Orange Cheeto Dictator suggesting this and thinking no one's talking about how dangerous of an idea that is, not only because it's dangerous to think about deporting American citizens, which is its own problem, but the impact on the criminal justice system would, I mean, if you're worried about, it would grind to a halt. And if you're worried, like from my perspective, I'm worried about defendant's rights and things like that, because that's where I come from. But if you're worried about victims' rights, every single victim will have to go to trial and testify. Every single one, including child victims. A lot of times, prosecutors want to resolve through plea negotiations because they don't want victims who've been through very serious offenses to have to go in front of an open courtroom with a whole group of strangers staring at them and describe it.
Right.
You know, that's true. That's re-traumatizing. And so if you care so much about crime and victims and all this kind of stuff, the threat of deporting American citizens who have criminal records destroys all of that. It just completely tears it apart. What's interesting is that if you think about it and you think like, well, because some of you might be thinking, well, at BLOC, if trying every single case would shut the system down and force prosecutors to drop lots of cases, then why aren't defense attorneys doing that? Like, why wouldn't you just do that then? Because then I'd get all these cases dismissed. And the answer is that ethically we can't, because defense attorneys, what we say is that we represent people, not causes. So mm-hmm. I have to represent each person individually, regardless of what's happened in other similar cases, okay. Because it's whatever is individual to the person and is good for, and safe for that person. I can't be like, every shoplifting I have, I'm taking to trial. Because what if it's a really obvious shoplifting that's on video and my person could get probation now, but after trial, they'll go to prison. Like, I can't do that. I can't do that to the individual. And ethically, defense attorneys can't do that. But if you enter the threat of deportation, and ethically, we not only can we, but we have to. Huh. So
that's what I was thinking. Funny thing, that's an interesting observation. But yeah. I don't know if you noticed, there was one interview with Mr. Trump where they talked about hearings and due process. And he says, we can't have 11 million trials.
Oh, God.
What say you?
Well, we can't in terms of like physically we can't, but he doesn't understand, like, even in immigration, and I don't work in immigration court, but I've worked with immigration attorneys. Mm-hmm. Often in immigration court, people agree to deportation because there are people that walk over the border from Mexico and they come and they work for a few years and they get picked up at a traffic stop and they're okay because they're going to get sent back, and then because they're just going to walk over the border again from Mexico and they'll be back in a few months, you know, kind of thing. So people, you know, agree to that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. All of my clients that have potential immigration consequences that plead to something, they'll know in advance if they're going to get deported. Like, they understand that happens. Right. So it's the same way. It's just like in criminal court. You don't have to try every single case. Also, I don't know where he got that number from. He said some high number, like 11 million.
There's an estimate there's 11 million illegal immigrants in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, then you're assuming then that every single one has to... You only get to, like a hearing if you're, like, trying to deport them.
Well,
there's plenty of people...
Is.
Yeah, there's plenty of people here illegally that, quote-unquote, illegally, that we don't have to deport.
Right.
Yeah, that we don't have to deport everybody. But that's a different issue.
Right.
But... Yeah, I've heard a few people talking about this from the point of view of, wow, it's super dangerous for our government to be talking about deporting American citizens. Yeah, true. It's also like the collateral consequences of
that's
doing that.
That's an interesting consequence that normally people wouldn't think.
Even if they just did it like once, if they took like one American, like born here in the United States, did some crimes, you know, bad crimes you want. If they did it once and they deported them, the entire country, I could tell you, every defense attorney, every public defender's office, it would just grind to a halt. And we'd just be saying, give me a trial. For every case, we would never get it. Nothing would ever get done. It would be crazy. So.
Well, then, Congress would then maybe have to pass a law to kind of not allow such thing and make it officially not.
Yeah.
I mean, it's also in the Constitution, but.
You know, but he doesn't know if he has to uphold the Constitution, though. Oh, what a great month for news. So those are our more serious stories. Just little ones. Just little tiny bite size. But now we have happier stories. What is your happier story?
My story goes back to a song that I listened to as a poor Polish child.
Mm.
It was a song called Disaster.
Okay.
And the basic lyrics said that something is a disaster or not, depending how you look at it.
Okay.
Right, so any event you can look at as a disaster,
mm-hmm.
and you can look at it not as a disaster. So one of the example verses was about some man who proposed to a woman, and she said, I don't love you, I don't want to marry you.
Mm-hmm.
He says that he thought it was a disaster, but then a few months later he said, no, it wasn't a disaster. So what I wanted to note is that our current president is the most degrowth and pro-climate president we've had.
Okay, all right, I like the spin. Let's go.
So, here's the evidence. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So, step one, he put tariffs on Canadian oil.
Okay.
Right. Canadian oil comes from tar sands, which is very dirty oil. It's when it's refined, it produces a lot of pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the rest of the oil will be moved to the United States, less will be refined, less pollution.
Okay, pro-climate, love that.
Increased price of cars.
More public transportation.
Fewer cars, less pollution.
Mm-hmm.
Less tourism. People don't want to come to the United States. Fewer flights. Fewer flights.
That saves a lot because the emissions from planes are very
That's
high.
That's right. The other thing that he's been talking about is his drill baby drill policy,
mm-hmm.
which wants the United States to produce more oil, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to reduce the price of a barrel of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Turns out that the oil companies cannot make any money if the price of oil is below $60 a barrel,
okay.
which is where it is about right now.
Mm-hmm.
So if the price goes down, they're not going to drill anywhere because it wouldn't make any money. It would cost them money.
Less drilling. Oh, okay.
And finally, you know, the whole degrowth in consumerism, you know, you don't need $30, $2 is just fine.
Right.
So... You know, depending how you look at things, something is a disaster or not. So that's my happy story.
That's fantastic. Well, that's good. I'm glad Donald Trump, the greenest president.
Yeah.
Orange is the new green. So my happy story, this might shock you, is also about the law. So we've had some good decisions coming out of the courts, finally, regarding immigration stuff, particularly the Alien Enemies Act. So in brief, the Trump administration has been trying to use the Alien Enemies Act to justify deporting people, primarily under the idea that they're related to the Tren de Aragua gang, and therefore...
It's an invasion.
Aliens. And then, you know, they just kind of wave their hands and then they can deport them. So now two courts, one in Texas, a federal court in Texas from a Trump-appointed judge was the first one that said, no, you can't do that. And then another judge, I think in New York, followed suit. And so this is sort of the beginning of the dominoes falling. So once one judge does it, other judges start to follow because they feel more comfortable than they just cite to the previous judge. Basically, the courts being like, we're not at war. The Alien Enemies Act requires us to be at war. We are not at war.
I listened to George Conway explain this. Basically he said, well, the law says it has to be declared war with another government. Has to be invasion by government.
Yep.
Or interdiction by people from another, you know, sponsored by another government.
Right. So, right. And it's clearly inapplicable. It's just like, everyone has known since they started. Every lawyer worth their salt went and read it on the internet real quick and said, this doesn't apply. And we just had to kind of wait for the courts to catch up. And unfortunately, sometimes the law takes time. But I think this is a positive lesson for us in that the courts do eventually get there. Like, overwhelmingly, in my opinion, the mom always says, the arc of human history bends towards justice.
Right.
The courts get there. We have laws in the books. Judges want to apply them. Most judges are not like crazy corrupt Clarence Thomas. Most of them aren't. Most of them are people that they went to law school and became lawyers, and they worked really hard to get their judgeships, and they don't want to just fuck it up for no reason. So the system gets there. And what I like about this is it reminds me of this ancient phrase that I think was originally in the Bible, but I pulled up the Wikipedia page, so I'm now an expert on it.
Uh-huh.
And it's that the mills of God grind slowly. It's the concept being that the mills or the millstones of God grind slowly, but they grind exceedingly small or very fine. And the idea, and it's been used throughout history, it was in the Bible, it was used in ancient Greece, it was used in Europe as well. I like this one. This one is from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. It's from a poem. Though the mills of God grind slow, yet they grind exceedingly small. Though with patience he stand waiting, with exactness grinds he all. So the idea is that sometimes it takes time to get to your just and final outcome, but that you do in fact get there. It's kind of a karma idea. You know, it's like an old school, oldie kind of karma concept. And it was used by Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes. Agatha Christie used something similar.
I believe that Isaac Asimov, Gods Themselves.
Oh, is that the Gods Themselves? I remember that book. We read that.
Yeah.
I didn't like it, but we read it.
I don't remember it, but yeah.
I remember because we read it and then I used it in a school project. So I remember the Gods Themselves. Yeah, he did. So I like it as sort of a life philosophy. And I say it to my clients all the time because when you're doing criminal cases, it takes years, you know? And it's sometimes if you're being wrongfully arrested, you know it when it's happening, right? If they're like, you did this crime, you're like, literally, I didn't. Like, you know that you didn't. But to go through the process takes all this time. And it just that's just the nature of it. That's the nature of the justice system. That's the nature of due process. That's why we have it, so that these things are carefully considered and we get to the right outcome. So I think what we're seeing now, as of April 2025, as of now May 9th, 2025, we're beginning to see that justice come around in terms of specifically the use of the Alien Enemies Act. This will eventually hit the Supreme Court on the merits, because it hit the Supreme Court on sort of a technicality before, but it's going to hit on the merits of whether the Alien Enemies Act applies. And when it does, I will cover it here because I'm curious to see what they do, because it clearly does not apply on its face.
Right.
But I think that's a positive thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Yay. Okay, well, those are our stories for this month, but I know you had follow-up on the...
Right, so I wanted to talk a little bit about AI. So, and AI and copyright. So... Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff you talked about last week kind of gave me some interesting ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So let me just review the definition of copyright is a work created by a person, a human person.
Yes, an original work of authorship. And that author has to be a human. Okay. Yeah. That is fixed in a tangible medium. You have to actually write that.
Okay. I'll record it.
Yeah, or record. Yeah.
So we also talk about Naruto Monkey,
mm-hmm.
which I love that story. And with the current AI tools, the what's called generative AI, there's really two parts of it. There's the input, which is the data that is used to train the models, mm-hmm. and there's the output. Mm-hmm. So first I want to talk about the output. And the kind of idea I had is that, should we think of AI as a monkey or as a brush? Right, mm-hmm. So a brush is a tool, I can paint a picture. Mm-hmm. Camera is a tool, I can, you know, it's complicated mm-hmm. technically, but I take a picture and the result is copyright me.
Yep.
So if AI is like a brush, then anything it produces is copyrighted by the person who used the AI to produce it, mm-hmm. right? On the other hand, if AI is a monkey, anything AI produces cannot be copyrighted because it's its own entity.
Right.
And mm-hmm. It's not clear which one it is, right? Mm-hmm. The funny part is that people who are like super pro AI and want to create these entities and talk about artificial general intelligence, they want AI to be an entity, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of like another kind of life. Mm-hmm. I think maybe Kara Swisher who said this, all these bros, you know, the guys, they want to create a life.
Yeah.
But if it's an entity, then anything it produces cannot be copyrighted.
Right.
On the other hand, if it's a tool, it's just a tool, which is what I think. It's really just a tool. So mm-hmm. anything that it produces should be copyrightable by the person who's driving the tool. Mm-hmm. So that's the output side. The input side, the models are trained by basically like reading all of Wikipedia or mm-hmm. reading books or whatever. So and then the model itself, once it's trained, can be used by many, many people mm-hmm. to produce other stuff. So I thought maybe the way to think of it, think of the people who produce these models as broadcasters, mm-hmm. right? They, like a broadcaster, like if I have a radio station or a YouTube channel or whatever, if I want mm-hmm. to play a piece of music that's copyrighted by somebody, someone created it and it's copyrighted by them, mm-hmm. I have to pay some licensing fees to do
yes.
that.
Yes, yes.
And there's compulsory rights licensing and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. But I just took my music law final a few days ago. So yes, there's many licenses.
So anyway, so those are just kind of my two observations mm-hmm. about copyright and AI. And I think saying that the AI, what it produces is not copyrightable at all, I think that's long-term, it's a wrong idea.
Yeah, I tend to agree. So this is actually something that comes up a lot in my classes. So all my classes are about intellectual property. And I'll give a historical example.
Okay.
So the law will accommodate new inventions when they're like cool and we like them. The law will be like, oh, that's neat though. I would like to use that. I don't want to make that illegal. So they'll find a way around it. So back in yonder days when the VCR was invented, there was, I forget the name of the case, but I think it went to the Supreme Court.
Betamax.
Betamax. Yeah. Oh yeah. You know.
How was it? Oh.
Betamax. I'm pretty sure it went to the Supreme Court. The mm-hmm. question was, you have a home VCR where you can, I forget if the question was the recording aspect or the replaying aspect, but both would fall under copyright. So the question was, you have like a home VCR where you can, you know, record from the television and also replay whenever you want. Both of those are copyright rights. So because you have when you own a copyright something, you have the right to reproduce it. And you have the right to display it, like a public performance mm-hmm. of it. And anybody who wants to do those things usually has to talk to you in some fashion. So then you introduce the VCR, which kind of on its face violates both of those things, right? Because you're copying something directly from the TV, right? And you're then able to replay it as much as you want. Like those are your Copyright Act Section 106 rights that the copyright owner is supposed to have. So on its face, it looks like that's an illegal thing to do. But the court said, but it's so cool, though. We like that. We like being able to record our show that's like on during the day when we're at work and come home and watch it. You know, we like being able to put on like the Disney DVD, or not DVD, video cassette. Well, tape,
video
tape.
Cassette, tape.
We like being able to put that on with our kids' favorite movie and like they can sit in front of the TV. Like, we like it, it's cool. And they like did fucking gymnastics to find a way to make it okay. Like to make the VCR okay in a copyright sense. But they did. They found a way around it. because they want to accommodate for new technology. So I think AI is similar.
Well, this goes further in history than that. Mm-hmm. So back at the end of 19th century, people composed music and songs.
Yeah.
They would publish sheet music so people could learn it and play it in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And then somebody invented the play a piano.
Yep, play a piano, yep. That's why we still call sound recordings of songs phono records. It drives me crazy. but yeah, the player piano was the same thing. It was like you could put in a device that automatically played it.
Well, what happened was somebody played it and then recorded it on like a...
It's like a cylinder of some kind.
It wasn't cylinder. It was like a sort of tape with holes in it. Or paper tape with holes.
Yeah.
And then you just sell the... It was easy to copy the paper tape.
Right.
With the right holes, and you give it to somebody. They put the paper tape into the player piano. Press a button and then the thing would play.
It plays, yeah. So the law has always made accommodations for new technology. I imagine we'll see the same thing with AI.
Yeah.
I think you're on to something with your ideas about it being sort of like a broadcaster. I think if AI ends up being qualified as a tool, then you get to a place where you can talk about copyright. The question is the inputs. And I think you're right in terms of like what we could do is have AI company X, whatever. Or not X, that's a real company. Like AI company.
And they do X, and they do AI.
Oh. So. Well, let's say B AI company wants to have a stockpile of images to pull from. And so instead of harvesting them sort of dubiously from the internet, we just say, if you submit your picture to us to use for a 5-year period, we'll pay you, you know, some money. We'll give you a flat fee. Or we'll give you, if there's a way for the program to tell if it's using the image, like we'll give you a licensing fee every time. It's like, just make a database where artists and creators are incentivized to submit their work for pay. So it's like, okay, you're somebody who likes to do like line drawings for fun at home by yourself. You're not an artist. You're just a regular person who like draws for fun on the side. You could submit your pictures to our AI service and like get a little money on the side. Just like, you know, whatever. Understanding that they're going to be used in AI images over which you will have no right, but that we have like that licensing agreement. I think that could work. I do think the law will find a way because it is just getting too pervasive at this point.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be hard for people to just drop it because it is cool. Yeah. You know, it is like, it's like, oh, it's just like the VCR. It's just like the player piano. It's like, this is kind of cool. I want to be able to do this.
Yeah.
But I want to be able to do it in a way where I know that the artists behind it aren't being cheated.
Right.
You know. But yeah. All right. Well, I think that's it for our
show. That's it for this time.
Yeah. Thank you for joining us here on Downsampled News. If you have any questions or comments, please leave them in the comment section. If you have topics that happen over the next month that you want us to cover, you can... definitely leave it in the comment section. If you want to follow me on Blue Sky, I am at BLock. I don't even know if you can see this. I'm at BLock on Blue Sky. I'll put it in the show comments. And you could write to me there as well if you want. Have any questions, anything like that. And otherwise, I think we're done.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, guys.
See you next time.
Bye.